going to teaches in the Islamic Center for Islamic Studies and teaches in the theology faculty. He's interested in Sufism and Islamic mysticism, amongst other things. And he's going to talk to us about surrender in Islam for some another 35 minutes.
Thank you. You will realize that my two predecessors. It's a bit like this. It all comes from the bottle. So, no, I don't need it. I can drink from the bottle if I'm... in some way, I think that what you should hear about submission in Islam was already said by my two predecessors. And what Islam would say about Christianity concerning submission was said very clearly by Keith Ward. I know far less about Hinduism, and I was very pleased to hear what I heard. And I think that sometimes the gaps that were referred to between Islam and Hinduism are far less deep than we were told. The problem is that you will find within Islam the same kind of wide diversity that was referred to in Christianity as well. And as we say in French, religion is a bit like Spanish inn. You eat there what you bring into it. And so depending the kind of reading that you will propose of the religion, you will always be able to build bridges over those different gaps. If I was, for example, really speaking of Islam from the viewpoint of the philosopher Avicenna, who dies in 1037, I would see great similarities between his understanding of the creation and what we heard about the higher and lower selves of Krishna. Avicenna says that, in fact, God cannot be himself without this project of being himself, being illustrated at all the lower levels of possible existence by things that would correspond at their level to his project of being himself, which was based on Avicenna's experience as a physician. In some way, God creating the world is God somatizing. But I will not go into those details about Avicenna. They would be possible to follow, and then we would have the bridges that are needed to bridge those gaps. But I would perhaps go back to the other thinker that I've been working on lately, Ibn Taymiyyah, a theologian who dies in jail in Damascus in 1328. He has the advantage of coming quite late, so he can look at earlier traditions and see what was done by theologians, what were the problems, and try to bring solutions. And Ibn Taymiyyah, about submission, would first say that we have an advantage, as submission is what Islam means. Etymologically, Islam doesn't mean anything else than surrendering yourself to God in order to reach peace. That is what the word aslama means. So, in some way, compared to the two other religions, we have this positive element on our side. But what does it mean? I think we will have to start with two main dimensions of surrendering. One is a dimension which is, in fact, beyond our control. We don't have to be Muslims, or we don't have to be believers. We do not have to be good doers, just to be aware that we do not control anything of the cosmos, of our life. That in relation to the creative will of God, in relation to ontology and metaphysics, we are totally submitted. We are in a total servitude in relation to the lordship of God. And that's just a common sense to accept it. And when Muslim theologians had to choose some kind of metaphysical system in which to express their ideas, in order to proclaim the exclusive reality of God and the nothingness of the creation in comparison to him. They went for a kind of atomism in which things were never anything but bunches of atoms and accidents who would even not remain longer than an instant and would have to be recreated in the following instant, which led, when those doctrines were known to the medieval Latins, to the modern philosophers, it led to the occasionalism of Malebranche and others. But if you want to have a representation of the world view of classical Islamic theology, look at La Grande Jatte by Seurat and other pointillist paintings. You know, you only have dots. But just imagine that that painting would not last longer than an instant without being recreated by Seurat, or in this case by God. That's what the reality looks like. There is far more void in it than created reality looks like. There is far more void in it than substance. And this is true not only for the world, but for self. And we are in absolutely no control of our existence as created works by God. And of course, until the period of colonization and the modern age, Sunni Islam, and I speak from this point of view, Sunni Islam was generally totally predeterministic. Totally predeterministic. It's only in the modern age that a heretical school called Mu'tazilism was rediscovered and that people started again to speak about their own freedom. It didn't make sense earlier on in traditional Muslim communities. But to speak of this total servitude in which we are ontologically speaking in relation to God, in fact, doesn't give us a complete picture, because it's only speaking of God as the creator, and it's forgetting about God as the source of revelation. It's forgetting about scripture. It's forgetting about prophethood. It's forgetting about ethics. It is speaking from the viewpoint of ontology, not from the viewpoint of religion. And as far as we are concerned, if we want to speak of God, I suppose religion has got to be involved in some way. And we have to recognize that we are perhaps nothing ontologically speaking, but through revelation we are nothing who is spoken to by God. And that nothing which we are must at least have this weight in the eyes of God that allows it to be spoken to by God, to be supposed to be able to hear God's commands and prohibitions, implement them, and follow the path to which we are invited. And very paradoxically, we are nothing which is invited to action. And it is only when we start following the commands and prohibitions that are given to us through prophethood and through revelation that we can indeed hope to justify ourselves in some way in the eyes of God. We stop being nothing, not ontologically speaking, but ethically speaking, because we are indeed contributing to the fulfillment of the creation of God by following the way we are invited to by the prophets. And so surrender is not just getting in total harmony with the cosmic order. Surrender then becomes a loving service of worship of God and a kind, if I'm allowed the terminology, of mystical praxis. It's in some way very existentialist. If you read Sartre and others, everything is absurd. We are not different from a root of a tree or from a stone. It's only when we go beyond ontology and metaphysics by opening ourselves to the voice of God, of course, Sartre was looking at it from an atheistic point of view, but it's the same structure in some way. It can be done by God and not against him. So it's only when we open ourselves to the voice of the absolute and start implementing the messages that we are given and surrender to those messages that indeed we can contribute in some way to what will become characteristic of humanity. And so, our servitude of God, the fact that we are all abd, slave of God, hasn't got to be understood in a purely passive meaning, as mu'abbad in Arabic, reduced to total submission, incapable of doing anything against the natural law, the cosmic order. No, it must also be understood in relation to ethics in an active sense, as abid, which means becoming a loving servant of God, contributing to the implementation of justice in the world. And you have two verses of the Quran that, in fact, respond to each other. The first one, at the end, around the end of the fourth chapter of the Quran, says, "O you who believe, stand out for God as witnesses to equity, to justice." And the other one, at the beginning of Surah 5, says, "O you who believe, stand out for justice as witnesses for God." Which means that the two have exactly the same importance. It is not just putting yourself in harmony with a world order. It is contributing to justice as well through your action. And then you'll say, yes, but this action can only be done by God. Of course, who are we? Who are we if we are able to go beyond this ocean of darkness with a bit of ethical light? Who are we then to start blowing our own trumpets? We will say, as the Quran says, we would not have been guided if we had not been guided by God, and we would not have been able to do anything if it was not by his grace. And so we will give him the credit for that. And if we sin, we will ask for his forgiveness. And he loves nothing but as much as the repentance of his disobeying servant. So surrender is not just passivity. Surrender is activity, and it's an activity characterized by ethics. What about prophethood then? I've said that it is as important from a Muslim point of view as theology. There is no proper theology without a prophetology, because creation is an opportunity for revelation, and it is through revelation that indeed creation will in some way stop being meaningless. And total surrender to God, of course, means total surrender to the prophets, because their authority and the authority of the last of them from a Muslim point of view is the same as the authority of God. But that's it. In some way, because we accept the authority of that last mediator, we are liberated from being submitted to any other kind of self-proclaimed authority, be it of a popish character, be it of a political character, be it of a charismatic character. We recognize the authority of the prophet, and that's our best guarantee that we do not have to be submitted to any other kind of mediation. And that, I think, is enormously important. Islam comes as a theology of liberation. And we will say that what Martin Luther tries to achieve against Rome in the 16th century was achieved much more completely against Byzantium, against the Sasanian Empire during the 8th century with the Quran. It is the same kind of freeing of human beings from all those self-proclaimed mediators who, in some way identify themselves with God in order to impose their rule on human communities. And if the Prophet is so central in Islam, it is in fact because he withdrew. He withdrew and he left the words of God to have the authority. And after him, anybody who would claim to be greater than the Prophet or to have a greater saying in religious matters than the Quran would be considered as illegitimate. Which means, politically speaking, that Muslims are very often difficult customers in terms of politics, because it will be very difficult for them to accept the authority of any kind of leader who would play with the religion or who would proclaim in some way that he has the divine right to rule. And we have a very critical reading of the history of European communities, especially from the 16th century, when you have all those kings and emperors thinking that they can inherit the authority of the church to impose their divine right to rule on Western societies. The only kind of authority that will be legitimate after the Prophet is the authority of the community in its consensus. And when there is no general consensus, the rule will be that Islam offers a menu and you can pick and choose. And there are various schools of law. There are 7 canonical readings of the Quran. There are 6 canonical collections of hadith of the Prophet, and nobody has got the right to impose one reading rather than another one. And if today you are not satisfied with what I tell you, go to another website. I have absolutely no power to impose on anybody my reading of the religion. Because at the end of the day, whatever I will have said, whatever you will find in any of the Sufi sheikhs' teachings or theologians will never be anything else than second-rate or blah blah compared to the authority of the Quran and of the tradition of the Prophet. And in the Quran itself, very often you have this kind of phrasing, and when my servants ask you about me, about this or that, tell them, you Muhammad, tell them. So he's there to be the teacher of his community. But then you have this verse which says, and when my servants ask you about me, I am near, I am close to them. So there is no tell them. So you get out of the way, Muhammad. It's between my servants and me, directly. And that's why, in some way, he becomes so loved by Muslims. He was, of course, elected by God. He delivered the message perfectly, implemented it in his life ideally, but he let this free relation develop between the individuals and their Lord within the community of the Muslims. And the only guarantee that we have that in following his way we are not going astray is when there are 2 Muslims. There is more truth with 2 Muslims than with 1. The hand of God is behind the collectivity, and what the Muslims agree on is a truth that the Prophet, as the words of the truth that would have been brought by the Prophet. So, surrender to God will mean surrender to the Prophet, and although on the last day we will be alone in front of God in this life, it is in some way not surrendering, but taking into account the opinion of other human beings. Not only Muslims, but others, members of other religions, and at the end of the day, we are all children of Adam and Eve. And so that must be taken into account. It's not pure individualism. What about then the Sharia? And the Sharia is probably what will make us the closest to Hinduism in some way. Because if we want to make sure we do not understand anything about Islam, we carry on translating Sharia as the law. Sharia is not law. Sharia, etymologically speaking, means the way, the path. And all the fundamental vocabulary of Islam is a camel driver's vocabulary and has got to do with following a path in the desert. And when Muslims will have to speak about law, because they don't have the terminology in Arabic, they will have to import it from Greek. Nomos will become namus in Arabic, and kanun will become qanun. And Muslim theologians have often considered that the transformation of this way into a legal system was a reintroduction of Judaism within Islam. A way must be wide enough to accommodate many things and many itineraries or ways of following a path. It cannot accommodate everything. And so, although it is not a law, it has got limits. And it is better to remain in the middle of the way. It's less dangerous than playing on the side or going for alternatives. And if we have to characterize this way, Sharia, the word only appears once in the Quran. It means that surrendering, being a Muslim, is not just taking into account every particular prescription of long treatises of fiqh, of jurisprudence, religious jurisprudence, as developed professionally by generations of scholars. It means to follow a path which is described in the Quran, the only time that the word is used, as Sharia min al-Amr, which is a path of which whose essence is an Amr, an imperative, a command. And the Quran itself is called a Furqan, that which distinguishes between evil and good. Ethics is the essence of the religion. And so surrender will mean indeed to follow that path of ethics, and it will be considered as demanding total obedience to God. Yes, but there is no obedience without love. How can you claim you obey somebody if you do not love being submitted to him? And how can you claim loving somebody if you are not totally obedient to what he tells you? It is loving what God loves, it is hating what God hates, it is being among his friends, and it is struggling against his enemies, it is going for justice and fighting against injustice. And then people will realize that a relation will develop between them and God, in which their ethical will is in total conformity with the ethical will of God, which is not automatically the same as his creational will. There are things that God has created and which he hates. There is no other creator than him, but what ought to be is not automatically what is, and vice versa. And so, when this relation of total correspondence, conformity of the human and the divine will developed in that total surrender, which I was calling mystical praxis, then indeed, as the Hadith Qudsi tell us, it's a tradition going back to the Prophet, but in which it is God who speaks. We have this relation, which is described in this Hadith Qudsi, as God loving his servant and becoming the ear with which he hears, the eyes with which he sees, the hand with which he grasps, and the foot with which he walks. It's not incarnationism. It is not unification of the human being with God, but it is an active presence of God in his loving servant. And I think that this would be considered by many Muslim spiritual masters as the highest degree that an abd, a slave can reach when it is his lord who is in fact acting and appearing through the slave. Thank you.